You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Israel mourns three murdered teenagers and threatens vengeance against Hamas, who protest their innocence just as fervently. Martin Plaut from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and Daniela Peled, editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, will join me to discuss that and the other big stories of the day, from Nigeria to Ukraine to an interrogation suite in the Nanterre gendarme shop. We'll also find out what it takes to turn Tallinn's diplomatic corps into an Estonian choir. And we'll have the latest from our man in Buenos Aires and our weekly music review this week, courtesy of the man who founded Dummy.
I try and find music that I think is, normally if I play somebody some music and they say, that is weird and I can't stand it, that is a good sign for me that it's outside of people's comfort zone.
All coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. And ahead of a typically eventful 60 Minutes, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
Israel is still searching for two Hamas Islamists suspected of abducting and killing three Israeli teenagers. Troops were seeking Marwan Kazwami and Amar Abu Aisha, militants from the Hebron area. On Monday, the bodies of the teenagers were found in the occupied West Bank, and Israel vowed to punish Hamas, the Palestinian group it accuses of abducting and killing them. Hamas denies any involvement, and a previously unknown group of jihadists has now claimed responsibility. The United Nations human rights spokesperson, Ravina Shamdasani, has appealed for calm.
We call on all Israelis and Palestinians to exercise maximum restraint and to prevent the situation from worsening further. We reiterate our call for strict adherence to international law by all relevant actors to avoid further loss of life, injuries, and negative impact on human rights. We urge all parties to refrain from punishing individuals for offences they have not personally committed or by imposing collective penalties.
Ukrainian forces have struck at pro-Russian separatist bases in eastern regions with air and artillery strikes on Tuesday after President Petro Poroshenko announced he would not renew a ceasefire but go on the offensive to rid Ukraine of what he called parasites. The Russian President Vladimir Putin said Poroshenko would now have to bear full responsibility for veering off the road to peace. Tens of thousands of pro-democracy protesters marched in Hong Kong today, many calling for the city's leader to be sacked. Many protesters, including legislator Lee Chuk-yang, were enraged by a so-called white paper released by Beijing last month that reasserted the central government's authority over the former British colony.
The Hong Kong Freedom Society, our one country, two system, high autonomy, is being threatened by Beijing when they issued a white paper claiming that all power lies with the central government. And so they may want to take away the high autonomy of Hong Kong. And so we must fight for universal suffrage to protect our system and also make it into a fairer society. So the whole Hong Kong survival itself is at stake.
The former boyfriend of Amanda Knox, on trial with her for the murder of the British student Meredith Kircher, distanced himself from his co-defendant on Tuesday, saying the two had not been together for the whole evening when the crime took place. Rafaela Solecido, convicted alongside Knox of the murder in 2009 and cleared on appeal 4 years later, was reconvicted in January this year after a retrial and sentenced to 25 years in prison. He is currently appealing against the verdict. A Francis Bacon small format triptych of his lover, George Dyer, made what Sotheby's called a landmark price of £26.7 million at a contemporary art auction here in London. The 1967 work was the star of the auction, which netted a sales total of £93.15 million. The auctioneer is Oliver Barker.
Not only is this small-scale triptych the greatest that's ever come to the auction market, but of such a great personality, plus the fact that it had been in all the major Bacon retrospectives over the years and stayed in the same collection from 1970 until it was brought to market now and was entrusted to Sotheby's to sell it. And it was an outstanding result, the greatest ever for a Bacon triptych.
And finally, in the United States, a Virginia man was in court after police said he led them on a chase after a pub crawl before crashing into parked cars. Charles Mack, who's 23, was originally spotted by Arlington police walking down the street naked after stripping at a restaurant. He then tried to flee in his car. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
We've all been there. Thanks, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, we have Martin Plaut from the Institute on Commonwealth Studies and Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both. We'll start tonight in Israel, which is mourning three teenage hitchhikers who were abducted on June 12th and whose bodies were recovered on the West Bank yesterday. Israel blames Hamas and has raided the homes of two alleged Hamas members it believes responsible. Overnight air raids on Gaza are believed to be more in response to a flurry of missile launches from the Strip in recent days. Daniela, I'll start with you. It is hard to imagine Israel being satisfied with knocking over a couple of houses belonging to suspects. How far-reaching might their retribution be?
Well, I think the consequences of this whole very sad series of events are likely to be long-reaching. There's been many accusations that the Netanyahu government have used the kidnapping of these three teenagers as an excuse to try and break down the recent Hamas-Fatah reconciliation agreement, as well as trying to undermine Hamas in the West Bank and attack targets in Gaza. The issue is now, though, that the Israeli public is very, very angry about this. The sense of national mourning is genuine, although it has been engineered to some extent by a government which, from the very early days, I mean, from within hours really of the kidnapping, it was quite clear to anybody, even without inside information, that the boys were dead. But there's been this campaign of bring our boys back, and there's this sort of idea that there's been hope for them. And so the tragedy, when it came, was really quite overwhelming. So the Israeli public wants something to happen. So do the right-wing members of Netanyahu's government. Problem is how far Netanyahu is going to go. He doesn't want to unseat Hamas in Gaza. He doesn't want to go in and reoccupy the Strip, but he does want to punish them.
Just staying with you, Daniela, is it possible to tell to what extent, you did talk about a little bit there about the public emotion being somewhat amplified by politicians, but is it possible to talk about who is driving who here? It is perfectly understandable, obviously, that people are angry about what is obviously a terrible, terrible, dreadful crime. But in other countries, in other situations, even when when murders occur in, you know, the most dreadful of circumstances, there isn't quite the same intense demand for general revenge.
I'm not sure it's quite a demand for general revenge. There are very right-wing elements in Israel that are calling for all kinds of awful devastation to be wreaked on Palestinians in general, in Hamas in particular. But there is this sense, historic sense in Israel, as cynical as one may describe it, it's a genuinely felt feeling that they are one family. There are 5.5 or so million Israeli Jews living in Israel. It's a small community. They're very fractured, very divided along ethnic lines, along religious lines. But still, one of the founding myths of the state is that of this communal unity. And this is an occasion where all of these issues have been brought together. The three boys, one of them lived in the West Bank, and they were all studying at a West Bank yeshiva. But they were just teenagers. Their mothers have been very eloquent spokeswomen for their cause. And yes, this has been something that Israelis of all stripes feel that they can identify with.
Martin Plaut, what have you made of the smiting talk from Netanyahu? Does he genuinely believe that a military response is actually going to fix anything, or is it just what he believes is expected of him, or what he actually just wants to do?
Well, with right-wing Israelis chanting death to Arabs, and this huge upswelling of anger, he obviously has to do something. There's no question that he won't do something. But the problem with, an eye for an eye, as Gandhi pointed out, is that it leaves us all blind. And, one just doesn't see where this is ever going to end because, yes, there were three children were killed, or young people were killed, and that is, of course, a tragedy, as you say. But, there were five Palestinians were killed in search operations for them.
And
we're not talking about them.
A three-year-old girl was killed in the strikes on Gaza this morning. I quite agree. But I don't think either side's aim on this was to bring about any sort of political movement.
No, and once you get into the sport of what the Northern Irish call whataboutery in the Middle East, you can be there all day. Does it help though the fact that everything? I suppose it's unavoidable in that part of the world that everything is perceived as having a political dimension, but where Israel and Palestine is concerned, it has one beyond the borders of Israel and Palestine. I mean, the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom don't feel obliged to comment and pass condolences on every murder that happens in their own countries, never mind other ones. Why does this one, this is possibly a naive question, become such a big deal?
Well, this has got more widespread political implications because it is about to set the situation on fire. I mean, tensions are super heightened, and not just with rocket strikes from Gaza into Israel and Israeli strikes into Gaza. There's also issues of what they call price tag attacks, revenge attacks by settlers on Palestinians, worsening of relations with Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews within Israel. But I think you're quite right, and many in the pro-peace or pro-Palestinian advocacy movement have said, well, when Palestinian teenagers are killed, perhaps they're not abducted in the middle of the night and beaten to death and buried in a shallow grave, or shot to death as these teenagers were. But where is the outrage? Where are the investigations? Where are the hashtags? Why is the world silent? So I think it's an important question to ask. Why has this been given so much attention, and to some people, not enough attention? But what would have happened? What could have brought those boys back? Nothing could have brought those boys back. They were dead almost as soon as they were captured.
If we want to understand where this comes from, it essentially comes from the trip that Golda Meir made at the end of the Second World War to America. And she said to American Jews, "You sat and did nothing as we were slaughtered in Europe. The Nazis killed us and you did nothing. And this must never happen again." And the lobby was born. The Israeli lobby is amazingly powerful and amazingly active. And if you don't understand what it's doing, you don't understand why Obama and, in this country is speaking out.
I think that's giving a little bit too much credit to the Israeli lobby in the UK to say that that's why
not
there's
in the
been
UK,
so much
but in America.
Coverage of it. Look, the Americans like Israel. It's nothing, not just the Jews. Americans support Israel. They see it for better or worse. And I'm not saying whether I agree or disagree with this as a bastion of democracy in the Middle East. It's not a question of the Jewish, particularly the Jewish lobby in America. I think the majority of Jewish communities in America are Democrats, and they do not support wholeheartedly the policies of the Netanyahu government. I mean, that's one of the features in recent diaspora relations, is the fact that the American Jews are getting further and further away from Jerusalem.
Martin Plaut, one of the many aspects of this case that baffles me is that Israel has continued to accuse Hamas of being responsible, which Hamas has just continuously denied. While I would obviously be wary of extending too much credit to anything Hamas may have to say about anything, what I can't see is that there would be any imaginable way that carrying out a crime like this would serve Hamas's interests.
No, but I've no idea who carried this out. I mean, I'm certainly not in a position to know the intelligence behind the accusations. But I don't know if you've seen. There's a wonderful film called The Gatekeepers, which looks at it's every surviving head of Mossad who says, this is why we killed these people. This is why we actually there was this retribution to hold the state of Israel safe. But in the end, every single Israeli government has squandered the opportunity to reach a final settlement. And frankly, there's no point in discussing why this particular atrocity appalling as it is any more or worse or better than anything else. There is no beginning, there's no end of this. It is an ongoing cycle, and the problem is political. And I would ask Daniela, where is the plan of any description from Netanyahu which says, this is our final aim, these are our permanent borders, this is what we're going towards? There is no such plan. They never come up with one.
I think you mistake me for a spokesman for the Israeli government. And
I'm not saying you are, but I mean, you know much more about it than the rest of us.
Nothing could be further from the truth. Listen, Netanyahu has no long-term strategy. Israelis in general are not known for their long-term strategies. They're master tacticians, and the IDF is
the
no. I agree, that's one of the problems. This is currently the most settler-friendly government in Israel's history, and I agree there is no peaceful solution on the horizon, and frankly, limited interest from the political echelons at the moment.
Well, having failed to sort out the Middle East there in the 10 minutes we allotted to it, but worth a crack, we will move along to Nigeria, where yet another bombing, this time at a market in Maiduguri, has left at least 18 people dead. Given Maiduguri's location in the heartland of Islamist group Boko Haram, there seems little doubt about the perpetrators. And in related news, Nigeria has signed a $1.2 million deal with a Washington DC PR firm to limit the damage to its reputation caused by Boko Haram's rampage. Martin, I'll ask you first, isn't spending $1 million on PR at a time of national crisis kind of bad PR in itself?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that certainly won't bother anybody in Nigeria. And of course, the $1.2 million is just the fee. On top of that, then, there are all the expenses of actually running the adverts and, you know, bringing out the publicity and all the rest of it. That's just the fee for the company that's doing it. But, you know, I mean, I don't think anybody cares. I mean, it's a drop in the ocean. Nobody gives a damn about that in Nigeria. I mean, the real problem is that since the beginning of the year, there's been something like 1,200 people have been killed by Boko Haram. And there's absolutely no end in sight in all of this. I mean, everyone is trying to do what they can about it. The Americans have got forces in there. The British are doing some training as well. Everybody is doing what they can. The end result, almost nothing whatsoever.
Is the problem that Nigeria's government can't stop them or won't stop them?
Well, both. You know, it depends what you mean by the government, because elements of the government in the north are thought to be using Boko Haram as a way of saying to the south, which they believe illegitimately now has the presidency in President Jonathan, you know, you can't leave us alone. You have ignored us for far too long. Where's our share of the oil wealth? And so, you know, there are elements in the government, and that is why it's been impossible to eradicate them up to a point, although it's probably gone out of control of the political masters. But that's one of the reasons they haven't been able to get hold of them. And there are also links between the military and Boko Haram. It's incredibly complicated.
Daniela, the PR company in question, Levick, have been retained to, as they put it, change the media narrative around the Boko Haram story. where do you, I mean, this is probably why they get paid $1 million a year to do this and I don't, but where do you even start with that?
Well, I was thinking that $1.2 million doesn't seem an awful lot, really, to try and turn this around. No, I mean, I agree with Martin. I don't think within Nigeria anybody cares at all about this. I think this is much more about outside image, you know, the country's branding. What do they do with it? I mean, can they move it away from the Nigerian email scams to Boko Haram to where? You know, the government has handled this entire business incredibly badly. It's just shown utter disdain, really, for the electorate. Although, good luck, Jonathan doesn't really need to rely on the North for his votes, and he would be quite mistaken to do so. There's been no media management. There's no media message. But then there's been no management to deal with an issue of this kind. You need, as Martin said, it's very, very complex. You need not only some sort of military strategy, but although Boko Haram, I wouldn't say have any legitimate aims at all, but violence of this kind is inevitably sustained by injustice. And if you don't address those causes, then there's nothing you can do really to bring about a sort of cohesive solution.
Is it being somewhat optimistic to suggest that Boko Haram can be reasoned with?
No, certainly not. But they rely on, these movements always feed on local injustice and local disenfranchisement. All those issues are there. I mean, Martin knows a lot more about this than I do, but it seems to me, and Nigeria might have the biggest economy in Africa, but as a state, it doesn't seem to be functioning very well.
No, not at all.
Well, that does bring us along more or less seamlessly to our next topic, which is later this month, the UN Security Council will discuss cooperation between the UN and the African Union in peacekeeping operations, which sounds reasonable enough, except that for all the well-documented flaws and foibles of various UN peacekeeping operations over the years, they generally look like models of efficacy compared to those undertaken by members of the AU. One thinks at this point of ECOMOG, the late 90s intervention in Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea-Bissau, whose acronym quickly became known to locals as standing for every car or movable object gone. Martin, I'll ask you first, Rwanda are driving this. Why?
That's a very good question. I wish I knew the answer to it. I think that they are trying to show that they are responsible adults, shall we say, in the international arena. I think they're on the UN Security Council at the moment, you know, one of the temporary members, and they are driving this because they... But also, you know, they've been under huge pressure themselves because of their own interventions in Congo, where they say, look, they are the ex-member of the Interahamwe, the people who were involved in the Rwandan genocide, are still hanging out in eastern Congo. And so every now and again, quite frankly, the Rwandans treat Eastern Congo as the Israelis treat the West Bank, shall we say.
Well, the RPF model's not really sellable, though, is it, as a model for peacekeeping? Because while it was effective, you could say, it was also exceptionally brutal. Not really the kind of thing you can do in a blue helmet.
No, that is true. Goodness me, that's a complicated question. No, but I mean, you know, the point is that some of the operations that the African Union has been involved in have worked. I mean, for example, the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM, had done quite well. But the reason it's done well is because you've got the Kenyans are in there guarding their borders. You've got the Ethiopians have wandered across the border and taken chunks themselves. So when people have enough of a national interest in doing so, yes, they can make these things work. But the problem is you get other places like Darfur or the Central African Republic, where, frankly, the operations have been an absolute nightmare. They just haven't produced the results they were supposed to. They've been standing by, particularly in Darfur, and just watching as people are killed. And there have been, you know, tens of thousands of people have fled their homes in this year in Darfur, and you don't see a word of this in the press.
Daniela, is it surprising that this is still, this inability of AU forces to sort out African problems still exists? We've seen, especially recently, Mali and CAR interventions largely going nowhere until the French turned up and took control of them.
Well, I think it's a good thing for African Union members to try and deal with the situation in their own backyards, as it was. But I agree. I think there's a long way to go with this. You can see this in the field of international justice, where the International Criminal Court is seen as showing, how can I put this tactfully, a rather unfair bias towards one particular continent in its prosecutions.
Or even against.
Yes, exactly. And there have been moves by African countries that want to set up their own regional court. But then again, this has already been beset by all kinds of accusations of impartiality and bias. I think we're at the beginning of a very long process when it comes to including African states. But that's also an essential part of it, because the UN can't come in and impose a situation on the ground, and neither can the ICC come in and impose justice on the ground. So there has to be involvement.
OK, so we haven't fixed Africa either. We will now take a short break. When we return, we will have a crack at Ukraine and we'll find out why the gendarmes have felt the collar of a former president.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Martin Plaut from the Institute on Commonwealth Studies and Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. We'll turn now to Ukraine, where a 10-day alleged ceasefire has been emphatically ended by President Petro Poroshenko, who has ordered Ukraine's military to take on pro-Russian separatists in the country's east. Fighting has now been reported in several regions. Daniela, I'll ask you first. This was mentioned in our news at the top of the hour. Is Poroshenko's rhetoric about free Ukraine from dirt and parasites, as he put it, a bit weird for somebody who at some point you would think is going to have to attempt national reconciliation?
I think the rhetoric has been seriously ramped up, and I don't think Europeans are terribly happy with him. They would have liked to see the supposed ceasefire continue. It's a very tricky one, because I don't think, right from the beginning, my impression has not been that the Russians are going towards one preconceived and predetermined aim. They've just been feeling their way through this crisis in a more intuitive way. And I think at the moment, the Ukrainians think that they've got the advantage now. I mean, the ranks of the volunteers have been enormously swelled. The Ukrainian army is very badly resourced. And there have been all kinds of collections from ordinary Ukrainians to send things like bulletproof vests and sleeping bags and so on to the soldiers. But the paramilitary groups seem to be increasingly better funded. So maybe he feels that this is somewhat we can finally unlodge and unseat this separatist movement.
Martin Plaut, it seemed about a week ago that Russia had sort of lost interest in or decided it had everything it wanted. Vladimir Putin even asked the parliament to retrieve from him his powers to make war in Ukraine, which was an extraordinarily humble gesture. But it did rather seem as if Vladimir Putin thought, well, I've got Crimea, I've turned Ukraine into a total shambles for a generation, that's not a bad couple of months' work. But now he's grumbling again about Russia's right to protect its ethnic brethren. Is there any chance they would invade all over again?
The idea of Mr. Putin being humble is a wonderful one. A man who wanders around with his bare chest and tells us what a wonderful, karate chop he has.
I thought he peaked, frankly, when he led the goose migration in a hang glider. That's still
yes, absolutely.
Or an ultralight or whatever it was.
But I mean, the problem is that we look at Ukraine as if it's a sort of separate zone all by itself. But I do have some sympathy for the Russian view of all of this, in the sense that can you imagine what would happen if, the Russians became deeply concerned about, goings-on in Canada or activities, in Cuba, which, of course, they once were. And look at what that happened, led us to. It led us to the brink of nuclear war. The Americans wouldn't put up with it for a moment. So why should we expect the Russians just to accept that they've after all lost the whole of Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia? They've had the Poles disappear from underneath them. Now, this is just one step too far. And so, Putin has pushed it along.
Well, they've lost all those states because those states wanted independence. What a disgrace.
Quite.
None of them were terribly keen on being part
of the Soviet
Union.
Cubans rather liked the idea of missiles and they weren't allowed those.
I'm not quite sure what you're arguing there,
On that note, we should move, and I just want to do this because I get to use my two favourite newspaper words in one sentence, from an embattled president. You never see embattled anywhere else.
Or beleaguered.
That's where I was going. Yes. We're going to move finally from an embattled president to a beleaguered ex-president.
My favourite.
See what I did
favorite.
There? I do like to get a beleaguered into the script.
That's a wonderful word.
It's a great word.
I can't spell it.
But it's tricky. It is a tricky one. But Nicolas Sarkozy is exactly that. He has been detained for questioning about his role in an influence peddling scandal, apparently about whether or not he promised career advancement to a judge in return for information about investigations into campaign funding. Daniela Peled, Sarkozy apparently does fancy another crack at this in 2017, which is a way off. People do have fairly short memories, but it's not a good look, is it?
Well, particularly because Hollande's government is really not terribly popular. You'd have thought that this would be the moment for Sarkozy to revamp himself. I think people's political memories are quite short. I quite agree with you. And there's all been kind of accusations in the French media. This is all some sort of conspiracy to derail his.
That's the card you play at this point,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the outsider that great forces are conspiring against. Martin Plaut, is anyone
going to
is anyone anyone going to buy a sort of anti-establishment rebel pose from a former president?
Well, I dare say they will. I mean, there was a wonderful phrase from a French journalist who said this morning when she heard the this news, she had to wonder which of the six scandals it was that he was being arrested for. So, you know, and also we shouldn't forget that there are plenty of other scandals that French leaders have been involved with. I mean, Jacques Chirac was arrested, and, you know, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, there's an African connection again. You remember the diamonds that he got from Bokassa. So, you know, it goes, there's a long tradition of this.
We will have to leave it there. Martin Plaut from the Institute on Commonwealth Studies, Daniela Pellard from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, thank you very much for joining us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty coming up on the second half of today's Midori House. We have the latest from our man in Buenos Aires. We have the choral stylings of the Estonian Diplomatic Corps, which is not a phrase you'd hear on any other radio station, and our weekly music roundup. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. Israel is still searching for two Hamas Islamists suspected of abducting and killing three Israeli teenagers. Troops were seeking Marwan Kazwami and Amar Abu Aisha, militants from the Hebron area. Ukrainian forces have struck at pro-Russian separatist bases in the east of the country with air and artillery strikes on Tuesday after Petro Poroshenko announced he would not renew a ceasefire but go on the offensive to rid Ukraine of what he called parasites. Tens of thousands of pro-democracy protesters marched in Hong Kong today, many calling for the city's leader to be sacked. And the former boyfriend of Amanda Knox, Rafaela Solicito, on trial with her for the murder of the British student Meredith Kircher, distanced himself from his co-defendant on Tuesday, saying the two had not been together for the whole evening when the crime took place. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan, and welcome back to Midori House. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 in London, 14:32 in Buenos Aires, which is where we're going right now to check in with Ed Stocker for a roundup of the news from Argentina. I spoke to Ed before we came to air. Ed, first of all, readers of the Financial Times woke up yesterday to a slightly bizarre ranting advertisement by the Argentinian government, all in interminable and unreadable capital letters about their attempts to settle the debt. It was very hard to comprehend what was going on from reading that, certainly. From where you are in Buenos Aires, how does this look?
Indeed, you're right about the adverts. They've taken publicity out in the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. Not the first time that they've kind of gone for this policy of trying to win over international crowds by publicising in foreign papers. Here, it's really quite hard to know what's going on. Obviously, Argentina is in a technical default. It's all quite complex, but it dates back to a Supreme Court decision a couple of weeks ago, declining to hear an Argentinian appeal against an earlier sentence. In a nutshell, it basically means Argentina now needs to pay so-called holdout bondholders. These are people who didn't enter into restructuring programs in 2005 and 2010. I'm talking about people who bought debt bonds and then settled for a deal back then, losing a lot of money but deciding they wanted to have a deal. The thorn in the side of Argentina has been the people who decided to hang on and pursue their money through the courts. Among the people are so-called vulture funds, funds that bought bonds years after the default for a cut price and then tried to recuperate the full amount of money back. Funds that, you know, Argentina refers to as vultures because they say they're speculative. What all of this means is that Argentina hasn't been able to pay its bondholders from previous agreements and has gone into this kind of limbo, I guess, this technical default. as you might realize from my explanation, it is quite complex stuff. But it essentially means that Argentina is in a serious financial problem with this technical default that could turn into a formal default at the end of July, when a 30-day grace period for payment ends. Argentina's kind of locked in a bit of a battle with the judge, with lawyers, with these holdout funds about what to do. It hasn't really decided that it's going to sit down and negotiate an end to this. Instead, it's been taking a kind of fighting stance, as you were mentioning in those adverts as well. Whether it's kind of in line, I guess, with Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the president's kind of populist rhetoric. But whether behind closed doors, and there's a meeting on Monday, an agreement is reached, remains to be seen.
OK, well, sticking with President Kirchner, she has other problems, specifically her vice president, Amado Boudou, who has been charged with bribery over the issuing of what was literally a license to print money.
Indeed. I mean, it hasn't been the greatest of news weeks for Argentina, with this default and debt talk. Then comes the formal charging of Vice President Amado Boudou. He's going to appeal, apparently, against the charge. He, along with five other defendants, are accused of corruption. He's specifically accused of bribery. A company called Chicone was rescued from bankruptcy and awarded contracts to print pesos, to print money here in Argentina. Basically, the vice president is accused of using front men or middlemen to basically acquire a stake in that money and therefore make money for himself in return for granting favors.
And finally, I guess, having talked probably enough about the bread, we should move on to the circuses. Argentina are, of course, playing Switzerland right now as we are on air, so we shouldn't really speculate about whether the country is about to erupt in further celebration or an orgy of disappointment. But how has Argentina reacted to the World Cup so far? And is there any evidence of de Kirchner's somewhat embattled administration trying to make political capital from it?
Well, firstly, yes. I mean, Argentinians are passionate about football. I think they give Brazilians a run for their money when it comes to South American passions for the game. And people have been pretty excited, you know, a lot of flag waving. People are out in a central square in Buenos Aires watching the game, despite the fact that it's pretty cold today. It's only about 7 or 8 degrees, it being winter here. You know, flags, there's even little dogs that have got their kind of light blue and white striped jumpers on to keep them warm from the cold. So definitely a lot of expectations as well, because, you know, Lionel Messi is seen as being the best footballer in the world, and he's kind of rescued them in the last few games when, frankly, they haven't been at their best. Talking about football and politics are never far away from each other in this country. It's quite staggering. Half the games are being shown on Canal 7, the state-run TV channel. You know, it's part of this football para todos, football for everyone. The government pays for the rights so that everyone can see the games. They actually probably have the best commentary, the best production, but the flip side is that you're bombarded with government adverts in the halftime break, and they don't even try and be subtle. They show the achievements of the government, but they're all football related, so they all have some kind of football theme, but talking about achievements of the government. And the slogan for every advert is Argentina includes us. So, you know, you can expect about 4 or 5 adverts, one after the other, during the halftime break and before and after the game. So it's a way very much of getting the government message across while people are enjoying their football.
That was Buenos Aires correspondent Ed Stocker with the latest from Argentina, where it is still, well, not in Argentina because they're in Brazil, but it is still nil all between Argentina and Switzerland. Up next, we'll be in Estonia to find out if local diplomats are in good voice. Stay tuned to find out more about that.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Otta Flower Market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's music festival season. Who writes this? It's music festival season all across Europe, which for most Europeans means spending weekends standing ankle deep in mud, and what they hope is mud, while squinting at Kasabian playing on a stage several miles in the distance. For those in the vicinity of Tallinn this weekend, a far more interesting and civilized treat is on offer. The 26th Estonian Song Celebration combined with the 19th Estonian Dance Celebration. Communal singing has a special place in Estonia, not least because of the role played by the so-called singing revolution of choral protest, which helped secure independence from the Soviet Union in the early 90s. And we're joined now by Estonian journalist and singer Liis Kangsthep, who is heading to the festival this week. Liis, first of all, for those of us who have not yet attended an Estonian song festival or song celebration, give us some idea of what it entails.
Well, it's basically a big celebration. Being Estonian and celebrating the power of singing and being together. So there are going to be about 100,000 people at the special field where the song festivals or the song celebrations are celebrated. About 30,000 of them are going to be choirs performing different songs. And basically it's just a fun day out with your family. It's a very family event. All the proper Estonians are really going to the song festival, or if they're not going there, they will be watching it on TV.
Because you talk about 100,000 people there, which is a big crowd by any standards, but in a country which barely has a population of just over a million, that is a fairly significant percentage of one country turning up at a cultural event.
Indeed it is. And I think it's because singing is something really, really Estonian. I think you would find very difficult to find an Estonian who has never been singing in a choir at least once in their life.
Okay, well we do have a short clip of some Estonians in a choir to give people some idea of what they'd be letting themselves in for. An example there of what might be on offer at the 26th Estonian Song Celebration in Tallinn this weekend. At least I did want to ask you, I believe this year for the first time the diplomatic corps, which is to say foreign ambassadors serving in Estonia, are going to attempt to contribute. I believe you've been to one of their rehearsals. Did they sound as good as that?
Well, I think they sounded maybe even a little bit better because they were rehearsing songs that are a tad more optimistic, I would say, or not so sad. Because, I mean, singing is a very important part of our culture, and of course it is very sad and very full of pathos. They're very important, but we also have a little bit other songs that are a little bit more happier.
How difficult is it to sing in Estonian if you don't speak Estonian? Because I'm told by people who study these things that it's a very, very difficult language to learn.
It is a very difficult language to learn, but I think it's a very easy language to sing because we have a lot of vowels. and so vowels really carry your voice, which means that it's easier to sing a language with a lot of vowels, I think.
And Lise, you are, of course, attending the festival, and as you said, like many Estonians, you do have some form as a chorister yourself. According to my producer, at least, you can be persuaded to give us a short solo burst of Estonian choral song.
Yes, I can. This is going to be my first time in a very long time that I'm singing, because I'm one of those very few Estonians who is actually not in a choir. I think the last time I sang in a choir was about 15 years ago, maybe.
Okay, well, way to lower our expectations there, but in your own time. Lise, that's marvellous. They are all applauding in the production booth as I speak.
Well,
what were we just listening to there, for those of us who don't speak or indeed sing Estonian?
Well, I think this is one of the most patriotic songs we have, and it's a very emotional song. It's about basically patriotism and going back to your home or to your country when the country is in need of help. And it's a very emotional song. It's going to be performed at the festival this weekend, as far as I know, and there will be people who are going to be crying during the song.
Because choral music, it has always been a part of Estonian national identity, and people have talked to me a lot about it during my two very brief visits to Estonia, and the last one of those was far too long ago. But is it one of those things that flourished especially under occupation, or at least amalgamation into the Soviet Union? Is it still a big deal for generations who've grown up just thinking of themselves as 21st century Estonians?
Yes, you are right that, you know, about 25 years ago, singing became extremely important for us, because this was one of the means that we used in order to get free from the Soviet Union. But as I look around in Estonia, I see many young people who are in choirs, and choir music and singing is extremely popular in Estonia. So even though that we are not part of an oppressive country or oppressive regime anymore, I think singing is something really, really close to our hearts.
Lise Kongstep, Estonian journalist on her way to the Lallupidu Festival, many thanks for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And as we approach the end of today's show, it's time for our daily review of one particular area of the arts. And as it's Tuesday, it must be music. And we turn to Dummy Magazine to help us out with this one. Dummy Magazine is a London-based operation launched in the same year as Monocle, but with a very different agenda. Dummy acts as a platform for the freshest music, with writing on everything from obscure electronica and futuristic R&B to upfront pop. Now, released this week, Dummy's 21st Century Pop Music Edition is an imaginative roundup of what pop can sound like in 2014, with music from South Africa to South London and most points in between. Dummy's head honcho Leo Silverman came in to talk to our resident music expert Paul Noble.
Leo Silverman, co-founder of Dummy and A&R Man Supremo, welcome to Monocle. We're here to talk about Dummy 21st Century Pop Music, which is your new compilation, and at Monocle we're very, very pro-pop music, and this is a very broad imagining of what pop music is.
Well, I think, first of all, thank you for having me. And I think that pop music is broad these days. One of the things that we liked about the compilation when we came up with the idea, or that we thought about when we came up with the idea, was the idea that pop music is a very multinational, multicultural phenomenon. And, you know, one person's underground is another person's pop and vice versa. And I think on our site, Dummy Mag, we cover things from a very broad range of sources, from Korea, from South Africa, from obviously from Britain, from the States, from China, and we think of it all in a very open-minded way as pop music.
And so let's talk about Dummy Mag for a minute. What was, when you set up in originally as a magazine and then went web only, what was the impetus in setting up? What was your manifesto for Dummy?
Well, I have a partner, Paul. He started a 90s dance music magazine called Jockey Slut, and he developed that while he was at university and eventually sold it on. And I think when he'd done that, he and his original partner in Jockey Slut felt that there was room for us for a similar magazine covering credible music in a credible way, and decided to start Dummy. But unfortunately, we started it, I was involved then as well, but we started it in at a time when magazines were just in decline because of the internet.
Yeah.
And the magazine, the original idea behind the magazine was that it would have enormously glossy photographs and fantastic writers. And as each issue went along, it became slightly smaller and the paper became a bit thinner and the photographers weren't quite as good.
Mm.
And I think we got to the point where we felt like we were really kind of getting off topic for ourselves. And at a similar time, he and I both kind of found ourselves a bit outside of the music industry. But it was a period in which the internet was leading to tons and tons and tons of great music appearing. And there were kids in their bedrooms who were getting a voice for the first time. And so he and I decided that what we would do was relaunch it as a blog. We had very little money because we wanted to be involved in music, even if we couldn't release records at that point. And we felt that that was the best way to really broadcast the things that we were excited about.
And you are a truly digital-only operation. You don't have an office.
No office. We're very holistic.
Right.
He lives in Essex. I live in London. We talk via Skype. That's how we run our business.
Fabulous. All right, let's get into some music. The first track is one of the tracks from 21st century pop music, and it's from South Africa.
Yep, it's a band called John Wizards, who are six guys from South Africa, and they play a kind of mix of warp style electronics with African kind of guitar music, and it's all a big melting pot of musical origins. And, you know, I kind of think really typifies what I think is exciting about pop music now, which is that it comes from everywhere and it sounds like everything.
It's a Mimi on the corner where no street, next to the super at the station, no coffee. What it is very hard to pin down. City Dixie is welcome you to Cape Town.
Some new music from South Africa. John Wizards, welcome to Cape Town. Cape Town welcomes you. And hearing lots of good stuff about their Glastonbury performance last week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely fantastic.
So that was that's the first track on Dummy 21st Century Pop Music. Let's just talk a bit about your A&R career, because as well as the magazine side of things, you are in the music industry, A&R being the hilarious artist and repertoire. But really, you're going out and looking for new talent and signing them up.
Yep, that's what I do. I've been doing it for 20 years. And I always think of A&R as the job for people that can't. I always think that teachers can, but A&R people can't.
But you're the one with the golden ears who goes out and hears something new and fresh in a band and decides that could bring something to the table and you know, really connect with the public.
That's true, yeah. I mean, I try and find music that I think is, normally if I play somebody some music and they say, that is weird and I can't stand it, that is a good sign for me.
Yeah.
That it's outside of people's comfort zone and therefore exciting and interesting. And that's generally what I look for when I'm trying to find something to sign. And it's true of this compilation. I've tried to find things on the compilation that I think challenge people's comfort zone a little bit.
All right, well, let's go to another track. This is, we're in London now, and this is Alauda.
Alauda.
Alauda. Where did you find her?
She just anonymously sent a track to the website, and our editor absolutely loved it, posted it straight away. And since then, she's sent us a few other songs, but she's very mysterious. She's posted a few videos of her with just her hair hanging down over her face and doing strange dances and stuff. And I have actually met her, so the mystery slightly changed for me.
She does exist. It's not two blokes with a laptop.
No, it's one.
Doing a cryptic.
No, it's one girl.
Okay.
And she does exist. She's very nice. She told me that this song that you're about to play is about an experience she had on Brighton Beach, where she saw some boys throwing stones at a seagull that was injured, and she wrote a song called Falling Star about it.
And that's Falling Star by Aloud, a very nice, sort of, there's a bit of a Cure thing going on there.
A little bit, yeah, and obviously Kate Bush.
Yeah.
And, I mean, dare I say it, a little bit of a kind of Coldplay thing as well.
That's Aloud. It wouldn't sound out of place on the Monocle playlist, actually, it's very nice.
It wouldn't fit on Dummy, that, though.
No. And this album, you're releasing it only on vinyl and download, is that right?
That's right.
What's the thinking there?
Vinyl is a lovely product that we're proud to make. CD is a cheap piece of plastic that we're not that bothered by.
Right.
That's really it.
Let's cut out the middleman.
Yeah, and downloads are fine. You know, they're very accessible and people like them. So, you know, we want people to actually be able to buy and play the compilation.
Yeah. Let's move on to your final pick, which is more music from London, from South London in particular, and that's Palmistry.
Yep.
Who or what is Palmistry?
He is a... He's a producer from Brixton. This particular track is made with two Chilean MCs, I think, Blaze Kid and Uli K. And I pick this again because I think it shows the kind of multiculturalism of British pop music at the moment. He's working with interesting people. He releases his music on Mixpack, which is a New York label, and his music is very heavily influenced by dancehall, which is obviously from Jamaica. And also, he's kind of part of this new kind of up-and-coming scene, which includes DJs like Sophie and A.G. Cook and a pop singer called Hannah Diamond, who's getting a lot of attention. And, you know, it just feels very current, really fresh, and, you know, really represents everything that Dummy's about, which is, you know, absolutely the cutting edge of music at the moment.
Okay, well... Dummy 21st Century Pop Music is out now, and it's on Dummy Records, so easy to remember. Leo Silverman, thanks very much for coming into Monocle.
Thanks for having me.
Ojo cerrado, me imagino que estás aquí. Tu cuchillo en mi espalda, y ya no pienso claro. Cachete manchado, con cada lágrima. No sé si voy a sobrevivir este año. Junto en mi sueño, deseo dormir para siempre. Extraño tu sonrisa, pero ya no existe. Tú eres mi realidad, mis ojos marcados con la fe en mi corazón. Tu cara solamente máscara por la fantasma.
That was Dummy's Leo Silverman talking to Monocle's Paul Noble. And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, Martin Plout from the Institute on Commonwealth Studies and Daniela Peled, the editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Today's show was produced by Alan John, reduced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Carlotta Ribello and Lucy Atkinson. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up after the headlines is Section D, presented this week by Alan John. At 2200, I'll be back for the Monocle Daily with Tom Edwards. This show will return, also hosted by me, I think, at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.